Hey there, you're listening to Paradigm Shift, a podcast about people building the future and pivotal moments in their journey. Today, Zayd and I are really excited to have Wei Ding on the show. Wei is the founder of Clipboard Health. Clipboard makes it really easy for nurses to find jobs based on what they're qualified for, and they can apply for roles and book shifts in a click. Over the last few years, Clipboard has been on a tear. They've grown, I think, like over 25x in the last year and a half or 2 years, which we're going to talk about. They've raised close to $100 million from top VCs, including YC, Initialized, Caffeinated Capital, most recently at a $1.3 billion valuation. We're super excited. Welcome, Wei.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm also super excited to chat.
So we thought we would focus on three broad topics today. First is your background, which is a super interesting. The second one is finding product market fit and iterating your way to the marketplace that exists today. And the third one is blitzscaling. I think you all are clearly experiencing hypergrowth and thinking a lot about scaling a culture and scaling new products and a business. We'd love to start with maybe the first part of it. I know you have quite an interesting immigration story to the US. Would love to hear about like how you ended up in Silicon Valley and what brought you here.
Yeah, definitely. So I immigrated from China when I was 9 years old. I actually went back and forth without my parents. And so obviously, I know there are a lot of immigrant founders. My parents, they didn't have a lot of resources, but they worked super hard and they invested a lot in my education and just spent a lot of time with me, teaching me things. And actually, one of the things that they taught me when I was, especially when I was in high school, I remember that helped me during my journey as a founder was not asking for permission to learn at a specific pace. And what I mean by that was, I remember doing this science fair project as a junior year student, but it was like my first semester. And my dad was like, I was trying to come up with some new algorithm. My dad was like, I think you actually have to know calculus. And I was like, oh, I can't. I'm only learning that my senior year. And he was like, why not just do it now? Just get a book. It's not that hard. You can teach it to yourself. And that, just remember that it wasn't a one moment kind of thing, but just that sort of mentality was not something that I was used to. But there were just a lot of those moments where my parents would always be like, yeah, let's just get a book. You can teach yourself. And so that actually has had a lot of direct consequence to how I approach problem solving in the company. In terms of how I landed in Silicon Valley, I went to law school at Yale, practiced as a lawyer. I didn't think I was that effective as a corporate lawyer. I didn't love the job. I love my colleagues, but the day-to-day work of a lawyer, I didn't think I was that suited for. So I left to do investment banking, which I realized I also didn't like. It lasted like just a few months there. And I decided to buy a one-way ticket to Silicon Valley, where I worked at a variety of different startups. I think a couple of YC startups. You know, you see all the highs, the lows, the dysfunctions, the things that people are getting. And I loved it. It was like hard to go back to a corporate environment after working in those startups.
And then how did you end up starting your own company? And what was the seed of the idea that motivated you to do that?
Yeah. So, you know, back to the immigration story about how my parents invested so much of their time and on me and my education, which opened up to me like so many opportunities. I wanted to do the same for others. And so the mission I had, it's just like a personal mission, is to lift people up the socioeconomic ladder. I remember talking about this even during my honeymoon with my husband and just thought, we don't have kids right now. There's no better time to start a company. I actually didn't think about a starting company. It was like, there's no better time to work on this mission than now. And left my job. I was working at another Silicon Valley startup, which is, they end up having a great acquisition. They're a super great company. And just started. Initially, it was not in healthcare. I thought it was, let me invest in people's education, right? So it's something very directly related to my own experiences. So thinking about people we could talk to, refinance their student education or finance their education. And then if they succeed, partake in some of the upside of their success. So that was like this model, which is now very popular, the ISA model, or maybe infamous, I don't know. It kind of started that way and then over time evolved into the current model, which looks nothing like the initial idea.
And how did you evolve into building a product in healthcare and for nurses specifically? That seems like such a unique and specific sort of market that would be hard to understand if you didn't have some sort of like inside track on. So how did that happen?
Yeah, definitely. So I remember working on this financial product. It was called Talent Capital for 3 or 4 months. I tried to raise money for it, totally failed. I talked to 60 plus VCs. I remember talking to a bunch of different users and I grouped them by the most numerous types. So like nurses was actually one of them. I was targeting software engineers. I talked to a lot of them, talked to doctors, talked to lawyers, basically looked at folks who would have a good path to a career, but maybe lacked the financial means or didn't know how to get started. And during that process, I learn the hard way. This is why it is important to talk to your customers, like, or your potential customers. These students or these professionals who just graduated, they didn't really understand this ISA arrangement. They didn't think they needed help on the financing front. So first of all, most of the doctors and lawyers said they didn't help at all. The only folks who actually I had traction with were the nurses I talked to. And what they told me was, I don't really care about the finance product, but can you help me find like a job at a hospital? Can you help me find a job that has a better schedule? Can you help? So it like organically happened that I started talking to all these people and noticed a pattern. And I thought, look, these are real people with real problems. This is not like a made up thing in my head. And why not solve it for this small group of people? So it kind of evolved into like a career coaching thing for them initially. And then over time evolved into this. But that's how I got started with the nursing population to begin with.
Yeah, amazing. That's a pattern we've observed in some of our conversations where you start out with an idea, you start talking to a bunch of users, and then it evolves into sort of what it needs to evolve into to be viable. And so I think where people get stuck is those initial conversations. How did you line up? It sounds like dozens or hundreds of those initial conversations. What did you try and what ended up working?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing is to just be shameless about talking to people. I get very shy doing presentations and pitches, but I love one-on-one conversations because at the end of the day, you're just building a relationship. You're trying to understand someone, another human being, and you're making a connection. So I try to every day set myself to send out 300 to 500 cold emails, make cold calls, and I use a variety of resources, right? I use LinkedIn. I would buy these lists. I would actually go on YouTube and find people talking about the nursing profession, for example, or in early days, like medical professional, and then like actually just email them directly. Now there are tons of, you can go on, went on Facebook groups, and I remember posting and being like, does anyone want to talk to me? And we didn't have money for the company, and the company hadn't raised any money. So I did it all with no, like, it wasn't like, I'll pay you $50 for user study, which you can do, but I just wanted to understand people's, and you get enough traction, enough people would talk to you that over time you collect these conversations, and then in the conversation itself, you can ask them like, hey, is there someone else who, a friend or a colleague who could talk to me about this problem? And most people who even said yes, like they were genuinely interested in having their problems be heard. And at the end of the day, most people just want to be heard. Like whether or not you can solve their problem is almost secondary. They just want someone else to listen to them. So I found that to be just a wonderful opportunity to allow these people to talk about their problems.
So it sounds like you didn't incentivize them with like $20 or $50. That's amazing. And how did you run your user research? This is basically user research, right? How did you run that conversation? What did you find worked best?
I found what worked best is I always preface it with, look, I don't want to sell you anything. I don't even have a product. I just want to get to know you. And I always start with very high level and then go deeper. Because if you start very targeted, it just people don't have the context. And then they're suddenly like, am I supposed to tell you my deepest, darkest secrets? So I always start with something that almost everyone can answer, which is like, where are you from? How did you get into the profession? What made you decide to be a nurse? Or like in for software engineers to be like, what made you decide to be a software engineer? Oh, what did you like about it? And then what's your own career goal? Think about it. I would almost think about it as your job is to be their therapist. So your job is to understand them on a holistic level. And then, of course, like later on, once you've built some kind of connection and rapport, and it doesn't have to be super long. It's not like you need hours and hours of this. I think even within 10 minutes or 15 minutes, when people feel like you actually care about them beyond these specific set of questions, then you can start asking more targeted questions. Like when I was doing the financial, like talent capital, I would ask them like, so how did you fund your education? But if you ask them from the get-go, like, hey, I have a series of questions, they may still tell you, but you lack the context. Whereas here, I felt like I had a much richer understanding of all of their constraints. And like, what do you care about with the job? Like, why are you even in this profession? Do you hope to eventually do something else? Do you want to stay in this nursing profession? And you just get to learn a lot more. Yeah, so I don't know if that's the answer to your question, but happy to go and go further. I was definitely high level to in depth.
That's like pure gold, because I feel like this is a problem that a lot of founders run into where they're like, I think there's a problem in the trucking industry, but I've never driven a truck. I don't know a single truck driver. I know lots of software engineers. I don't know any truck drivers. And what do I do? And then like within 5 hours, they're like, I give up. Or they like come up with a bad idea. But this playbook, I think, could work for anyone. And I think it's really cool, like the scrappiness that you showed and like shamelessness that you showed in like collecting this information. Once you had that validation from these people, how did you go from that to actually like testing it in market? What was your like MVP like? And yeah, I'm curious, like what was that first kernel of activity that showed you that, oh, this can actually work on the ground?
Yeah. So first of all, I had 8 different MVPs, not all at once, but it's essentially the first thing I built was not the current marketplace. I think I had like a coaching fellowship thing. I was trying to make something prestigious where people would be a part of a fellowship and my job wouldn't be to teach them how to be a nurse. So the first set of problems I realized I was targeting a lot of new grad nurses was they want to help finding a job. And so I would go about and teach them how to interview, given that they don't have that much experience, how to polish their resume. So that was one. But then I realized it was really hard to monetize. Yes, I want to help them and we can still do that now, but you can't like make a big business out of it. At least I couldn't be the person doing it. And then so I switched tactics. So it's just like trying a bunch of new things. Then it was like, all right, this is not working for a long-term business. What about, I think I did like Quora type thing. I did 5 or 6 or 7 different ideas. And the one before this marketplace model, which probably the most relevant one, was I made a job board for the nurses that was very specific or tailored to the healthcare industry. So unlike Indeed or Craigslist or something, you can filter by schedule, which was very important to them. You can filter by whether it was a direct job or a job where you work for an agency. And then on the employer side, I actually go to these, I try to, again, it was like cold email, cold calls, and go to these employers and say, hey, you can post a job on our site. We can help you find full-time work. And so the MVP there, I'll just tell you about that specific like period of time. It was like 5 or 6 months. Would be they would post a job on our site. Actually, I would post it for them because the site wouldn't work half the time. And then I would give them candidates. Essentially, the candidates would come to me and then I would like make a polished resume for them and then send it off. And then I would coordinate all the interview schedule. So essentially, the thing they got was like a person with a schedule. And then that was the MVP, which was super manual. Like there was like a job board, but really they didn't even use it because I would do all the work for them anyways.
Wait, having sort of met you like 5 years ago when you were early. I know you were a solo founder and I know you went to law school and you didn't study computer science as far as I know. So how were you sort of like hacking together these MVPs? Did you kind of like teach yourself to code? Were you like putting together like something scrappy? How did you approach that?
Yeah, I just taught myself how to code. I feel like it's easy to be like, let me find a technical co-founder. And honestly, if you knew a lot of potential candidates, I think that's definitely a very good path. But I didn't know, I actually had a lot of friends who were founders, but I don't think any of them wanted to initially work with me. Like, it's not like we knew each other in the working context. And then they also had to be technical and also believe in this idea and also want to work with me. It was like a lot of constraints. And I just thought that if I'm going to invest a year finding a co-founder, I might as well invest that time in teaching myself the same set of skills, even if it means I'm weaker, but I can at least start getting. I think I just really don't like having constraints to getting things done. If it's always, okay, I'll do this when X happens, then you're really setting yourself up to, you can only do things when X happens. And I'm like, why not just make X happen somehow? So yeah, that's why the site was not good. There's a lot of problems with it, but there were a couple things that were good about it, which is one, like I gained a lot of confidence and also in confidence in my ability to assess people. Because once you've actually spent time doing programming, even if you can't assess the difference between maybe good and great, but you can tell the difference between like good and like bad. So I think there was that. And the second part is you realize there's a lot you can do without having a technical co-founder. And I think the main benefit of having a co-founder at all is like psychological. You have someone you can bounce ideas off of. When things are rough, you have someone who's there for you. And we had good early team members who acted as that. I had a great support network of friends and my husband. And I think that, so I felt like I kind of duct taped together these different pieces. And so I didn't need it to be in one person where they were both my friend and co-founder and technical and had all this other stuff. But I had these different pieces just pieced out together.
Amazing. So you were super driven, like quickly iterating through 8 MVPs, and you started to like hone in on the marketplace idea through manually creating schedules and resumes and posting jobs. Amazing. At what point were you, okay, this is starting to work. I think this is it. Let's go.
I know this sounds crazy, but I still don't think that. So don't ask me. I think at the point, okay, there was a point though when I was like, I think there's at least like something here. I don't know how big it can get. And that was when, so what happened with the job board was I kept on giving people candidates, but they kept on failing them for scheduling reasons. And that was really frustrating to me. So what I would call the customers myself. A lot of these were staffing agencies who were posting jobs on the job board and they were staffing for healthcare facilities. So I called their end customers. I knew who they were because I asked them, I'm like, who are we even staffing for? And I would call them directly and I would say, hey, I'm working with the staffing agency. Do you care if the same person shows up? Blah, blah, blah. And they were like, no, it's as long as there's like a body there. So I kept on hearing the same thing over and over. And at that point, I actually shut down the job board, which was making a little bit of revenue, but not much. And then just started going directly to the facilities and saying, we have the solution. We actually had nothing where you can get someone. But I had confidence because I had worked with these agencies on how to do it. I was like, if you sign this contract, then we can get folks to fill open shifts. And we just saw a very quick uptick. And just like I was able to do these sales after some period of time. It actually took a few months. But once I figured out how to position it, and I saw that these sales were really successful and that there was that need, that's when I was like, oh, there is something there. There's like a lot of demand for this product or its service, whatever you want to call it. And I was able to fill a bunch of the initial shifts myself. And I saw an opportunity I just saw that it was possible to give them what they wanted. And so I was like, there is something there. Now, I don't know how big it's going to get, but there's definitely demand for some segment of the population.
Yeah. So bootstrapping liquidity on both sides in a marketplace can be notoriously hard. So let's dive into that a little bit. How did you do that on the employer side? And it sounds like you were selling directly into healthcare facilities. That sounds hard. Like, how did you get those first 10 providers? And then how did you do it on the nursing side? And why do you think there was this like latent need for shift-based work in the nursing population when it didn't exist in a bunch of other categories?
Yes. So first on the demand side, I remember this very distinctly because I started when I was 7 to 8 months pregnant. And so I remember Ubering around. So I actually just literally typed in on Yelp, like healthcare facilities, because a lot of my customers were actually based up in Seattle and I didn't want to compete directly with them. Because I just felt like my early customers, the staffing agencies, they were really good to me. And so even if we eventually got there, like that was not going to be the place I was going to get started. I wanted to start in the Bay Area, which is where I was residing. And I thought you had to do in-person sales. So I actually just went and Yelped a bunch of healthcare facilities and Ubered around and just went into the facilities door-to-door sales. We'd sit in the waiting room, ask for the administrator. It took 2 months to actually get our first contract because I didn't know what to ask. I didn't know who to ask for. I thought in my head, I was like, oh yeah, you just get a contract. That's what the staff agency had told me. And I was like, I'm looking for a contract. You don't even know what you're asking for. And then over time, you realize, okay, there's the administrator of the building and then there's the scheduling coordinator and they're the ones doing the schedules. They have influence, but they can't sign. And so you just learn over time by talking to them and gaining their trust and establishing their relationship. And yeah, I did door-to-door sales for the first couple months. But then when I had a baby, it was hard to do. So I started just doing cold calls. And I realized it was probably 80% as effective, but it certainly saved me a lot of commute time. And then I built a team around just doing inside sales at that point. On the provider side, I would do basically what I did when I was doing the user interviews, which is why all of this stuff really helps you, even if it's not directly, right? Like I LinkedIn folks, people, I did stuff on Indeed, ZipRecruiter. You go to the job boards, you go on Facebook groups, you have partnerships with different nurse specific groups. And that's how I like, quote, bootstrapped the healthcare provider side. And then what was the last part of that question?
Why do nurses want this? What is like the reason that they want shift based work and not just like a job, like a one time, like a regular full time kind of gig?
Yeah. So this is not something I didn't realize until even recently, knee deep in more the healthcare industry to begin with. So almost all of the healthcare jobs by clinical staff is shift based, whether you're full time or you're part time or you're per diem. If you think about the doctors you see, they are working a shift. They're not getting a salary. They're getting paid for that shift. I have friends who are surgeons or ER doctors, and they talk about it not like I worked a couple of weeks this month. They talk about it as like I worked 20 shifts or I worked 14 shifts. So the unit of work is already in shifts. And I think the reason is for these operations, they are 24/7, right? It's not like a software company where people go home at 6 and probably nobody is going to suffer. When you're running a hospital or any kind of health organization where you're dealing with patients and something urgent, usually it's like you need coverage. And so the unit of time is already in shifts. It just so happens for someone full time, they're working 5 shifts a week, for example, or 4 shifts a week. There is that advantage in healthcare that probably may not already exists. Like you don't have an engineer working, yeah, quote, a shift.
It's clear that healthcare facilities are labor constrained and they probably have people drop off of shifts. And so there's probably like, if you think about the demand for nursing expertise, there's probably always 10 or 20% at the margins where like they need to fill it at the last minute. And so it sounds like that's what's driving the demand for this kind of marketplace. And then on the nursing side, what's driving that? Is it that they already have jobs and then they just want to pick up a few extra shifts to make some extra money? Or do they like the flexibility?
Yeah. So we definitely see this bimodal distribution where people either have a full-time job, and by full-time, they're working 3 to 4 shifts a week already somewhere else, but that's their full-time job and they want to pick up extra shifts so they can make money. Or something like 20 to 25% of our healthcare workers are just using us for a full-time job. Like they're creating 4 to 5 shifts a week out of the different shifts available in the area. And really what it comes down to is they want flexibility, which all of us want, quite frankly, right? Like there's always this trade-off of stability versus flexibility. So ideally, yeah. You have a job where you can always get enough shifts to fill a schedule, but you get to choose when those are, right? You can do like 2 shifts today, like that's 16 hours. And then you can do 2 shifts tomorrow and then you're done for the rest of the week. You get like essentially a 5-day quote weekend, which is really phenomenal for some of these people who have children, for example, and like other things going on in their lives. And someone else may want to do the just 8-hour shifts a day, which is like essentially like the equivalent of like a normal work week. And flexibility is really huge, especially in a physically demanding job. Like they're on their feet all day long. I can sit on my laptop for probably 10 hours a day. I mean, not straight, but off and on. But like you're running around, you're lifting patients, you're doing a lot of physical work. And so I think it's probably even more important that they have that level of flexibility. So I think flexibility is the first one. And then now, like, we also pay them faster than industry standard. So we pay them when their shift is over. And for a portion of our healthcare workers who are not the highest on the high end paying, like they're not the nurse practitioners, the registered nurses, the certified nursing assistants, some of them live paycheck to paycheck. They're just not getting paid that much. And so they want access to funds faster. So that's another value proposition of working through us.
And on the healthcare facility side, is there also a bit of an economic advantage to hiring from you versus paying overtime to some of their existing staff? Is that a thing or not really?
Yeah, that is definitely a thing. Like, I think that's like always something on their mind, which is like, sometimes it's not just, it's like overtime. And then now I have to pay a bonus to this person, to like an employee, because otherwise they're going to get burnt out versus someone who's going to be fresh, like who's choosing the shift because they want to work the shift. Now that said, I still see a portion of our customers who prefer full-time staff because I think there's this, it's kind of like the inherent belief and stigma versus like reality, right? Like, they believe that even if it's costlier, they think that their own full-time staff may be more reliable, there's continuity of care, et cetera. And so we're actually having our company, so we have this core product now, but what I was saying about some of the new products we're working on are to address that specifically, which is to help them with their own full-time staff retention and ways to make their own full-time staff partake in the same level of flexibility that people on our platform get.
If I'm a healthcare facility and I have a core set of nurses and a newer nurse or like someone that's showing up for their first shift, you probably don't want them working on like their riskier stuff. I don't know how you define it, but there's probably a category of things that you don't want them working on. So how have you tackled that? Or have you found that's limited your sort of opportunity space in terms of the kinds of shifts someone can do from like the clipboard marketplace?
I think that's definitely true for specialty areas. We wouldn't want to put a nurse in an operating room and doing surgery when they don't have that experience. So I think in certain clinical settings, that is true. Like you need people with specific type of experience and orientation and training. A lot of the facilities we work with are doing, I would say less, they're not like acute type work. So the majority of the nurses already have training that. So we're talking about giving someone medication, which almost all nurses know how to do. Or for a certified nursing assistant, it's lifting a patient out of their bed, which if you've done it once, you know how to do it. It's not like you need a bunch of training for that. But I think as you look at different verticals, that's definitely going to be true. Like there's definitely going to be some portion of or some specialties. Like you can't just walk into an emergency room having only done home health and then know exactly what to do. Or labor and delivery, right? Like you don't know how to deliver a baby just because you know how to lift a patient. So for those things, over time, as we layer on more specialties, we're definitely going to have to make sure that they have the proper training and orientation.
Got it. That makes a ton of sense. So clearly you're a learning machine. You're learning and you're still iterating and growing and refining and honing in on the ultimate, like, greatest and best product this can be. But based on what you know so far, what do you think this future looks like where you can do shift work on clipboard and maybe there's a few other products that emerge in other categories? But what does this mean for the future of work in a sense? Like, how do you think about that?
I actually think our product is going to be a commodity and one day soon, like soon being in the next 2 to 5 years. So I don't think we're going to have anything that special, which is why I think it's important that we are helping everybody get access to this. So it's not like you have to be a gig worker on the platform to take advantage of flexibility. And so we're working on a lot of products for full-time staff to give them access to pay faster. So what we're working on now is scheduling, helping full-time staff with flexibility around their own scheduling. And so I think, like, I obviously have a huge belief in the marketplace. We're spending most of the company resources on that. But I think that whatever you have that is new anyways is going to get outcompeted at some point or become a commodity. And so our job is to bring this sort of flexibility of work, you know, choice of location into the rest of the workforce that want the stability of a full-time job. So they don't want to just be like picking up a couple of shifts here and there. They want the full stability, but they also want the same amount of flexibility.
Would love to pick up and ask about the business model.
Yeah.
What is like the, once you arrived at the marketplace, how do you think about the business model and what format did you land on?
Yeah. So the business model is pretty straightforward in many ways. It's like a take rate. Like with many marketplaces, we charge the facilities a certain amount. We pay the nurses a certain amount and then we take in that, which actually matches with roughly what they would pay above their full-time staff. And which is why we're trying to make it like try to almost like cost neutral to them, except they also get the staff that they need. I think that, you know, what's interesting is with the new products, those are going to be based on a totally different business model that we're still working through. The main one is the sort of the take rate.
And what's the range of the take rate? Like 20, 25%, something like that?
It is, or, yeah, so about 20 to 25%.
Okay, that makes sense. And you have this amazing kind of culture, like kind of Notion website, which we went through, and it's super, there's just so much interesting stuff in there. Of course, one thing that catches our eyes, like you published a lot of metrics, like from your Series C deck with the round that Sequoia led, or maybe Series B.
It is,
B.
Yeah.
Yeah, Series B. And like the revenue chart is just like crazy. Like it's ending December 2021, but it's the prototypical hockey stick. And I think you grew 25x over the preceding 18 months. So very impressive. Curious to hear, like, what were some of the like key inflection points in that? Like, what drove that? Like, clearly there's a point at which like you're growing, like July 2021, it just like starts going like vertical. So what were some of the learnings that unlocked that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there are a few. First of all, it's never one magic bullet. It's always like 1,000 or 100 different things you're doing. From the product perspective, we've made onboarding self-serve. We automated a bunch of document review. We went from verifying each shift before they get booked to with the facility to now having it be instantly booked. There's simple things like that, all of which contributes. I wouldn't say it's any one particular thing, but there's like a bunch of automation work. And then there's straight up just execution. And that's like unbundled into both like the stuff that you're doing, but also like who you're doing it with. And so hiring, for example, is really big for us and really improving the quality of the hires. Because at the end of the day, you have a great strategy and you can say, we need to do X, Y, and Z, but it's who's actually doing the X, who's doing the Y, and are they going to do it at the quality you want them to? So really working through our hiring pipeline, making sure that we're assessing people and that they have the skills and are a good culture fit. So that's another one. And then, of course, there's always macroeconomic conditions that help, right? I think this is like, it would be false to say it was all execution, all just our product, because so much of it is going to depend on whether or not there is that need. And that need is driven by a bunch of different factors. And the thing I always think about is, okay, that's great for now. Do we see that this is going to be sustaining? And if not, what are other things we should be doing so that we're sort of diversifying our bets? From a macro perspective, like there's been a demand actually even pre-COVID for staffing, which is why we were working with these agencies to begin with initially. And I think that demand is likely going to continue for some period of time, but maybe not forever. We don't know. And so being aware of the macro conditions and sort of running towards it and like figuring out like where do you think things are going to land and then creating opportunities for yourself within that realm is something that we were doing and we'll continue doing as well to drive growth.
Okay, got it. I remember also reading that a lot of the shifts that are scheduled, at least initially, would go unfilled, like unworked, like something like, I don't know if this is a real number, but like in one of the docs, it was like 17% of the shifts that actually got booked would be no-show, which is insane. I'm curious, like what's driving that type of behavior? Like you would think if someone's opted into working into a shift that they would like clearly want to show up. I'm sure the reality on the ground is quite different, right? From the outside in, it's always so simple.
Yeah, I think this is the difference between having a full-time job and someone you're totally accountable for from being accountable just for yourself. First of all, things do come up in life, right? You have family emergencies, et cetera. But beyond that, I think there isn't that level of loyalty they have to a platform that they would to like a one employer where they could get fired. And I think the other thing is we were very lax in our policies. So if someone called us and said they were sick, we almost always be like, okay, you're sick. Obviously, you shouldn't go to work. And so we have done things to tighten up that whole process. It doesn't get rid of no call, no shows because there's always new players and you don't know how someone's going to behave until they've at least had one transaction. But we are much stricter with our attendance policy now. And like, you get deactivated if you have too many call-offs and or if you don't show up and or if you show up and then you leave work early. We're getting reviews from the facility. And it goes both ways. Like, the healthcare worker also reviews the facility. So I think that helps hold some level of accountability to the marketplace. And so actually that number has really dropped to, I don't know, I think it's now single digits. So it's dropped dramatically just from a bunch of these policy changes. But yeah, that's something that we definitely like want to continue working on, because we understand sometimes things come up. And so we're even doing things like, we'll fill a shift for you if someone just doesn't show up. And then we'll figure out whether or not that is an excuse behavior or wants you to not be on the platform.
So we talked about the early days and getting to something that kind of works, and then this like insane rapid growth in 2021, which probably COVID helped a little bit with. Having the right product at the right time was probably part of it. So what does it look like today? What is the scale today in terms of like your team size, your GMV, or whatever you feel comfortable sharing? And on the provider side, like we talked about like this door-to-door sales, like what does that look like today and how fast is it today?
Yeah. So right now, all the sales motion is done remotely. We don't have anybody doing door-to-door sales. But as we're going into new verticals, like selling to hospitals or moving up the stack to enterprise sales, we believe that there's an opportunity to do more in-person sales. I'm actually going to a conference to talk to folks in the healthcare space and seeing whether that improves our sales motion from a just like ROI perspective, like going to a conference, how long does that speed up our sales process? We've doubled in revenue since the last round. We've continued growing, and I think we've doubled in headcount. Actually, I don't know if we've doubled in headcount. The headcount number, to be honest, always escapes me, because sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, we have a lot more people than I thought, which I don't think is always a good thing. I think our job should be to make sure that we're serving our customers. And sometimes having a lot of people means that there's no one person serving them correctly. But I think our headcount has roughly doubled since the last round as well. So yeah, that's where we are. But most of my focus now is on not finding product market fit so much as getting new products that we think will really serve our existing customers even better than the core marketplace. And then we have a great team that is currently running with scaling the core marketplace.
So based on public numbers you've shared, you must be like north of 1,000 employees by now, I'm guessing.
And no, actually, no. Then we're about, I think our team is like 700 or something. 700.
Okay. That's insane growth. Very fast. And I remember when it was just you like working in the US alone. And I think you might have had a couple of remote teammates around the world. And that wasn't that long ago. That was probably like 3-4 years ago. And so that's a lot of growth, and growth is really hard. Like, you know, how has that been for you to shift from building the product to like building the company and the team? What have been some of the things that have worked? What are some of the things that have been really hard? It seems like you've done an incredible job there. You've built a great culture that's fast moving. So we'd love to hear some of your reflections and lessons from that phase.
Yeah. So first of all, I actually love the small company phase. I love that when everybody knows everybody else, everybody knows everything that's going on. I think I actually always look fondly upon that phase. And it's very different from now, where I can be sometimes like 4 or 5 layers removed. So I've had to really shift gears into... Actually, it's funny. Now, if we shifted back into the 0-1 phase, but for a period of time, especially before the last round and a few months after, so much of it is on hiring and management. And like, hiring is like, you have to figure out like, what is not just the process, but what are you looking for and how do you evaluate? So for example, do you give people case studies? If you do give them case studies, which we do for a lot of our, for example, product hires, what are you looking for? What's an example of an excellent case study? Like, that actually does take a lot of time to figure out. And because you want to bring people who essentially try to get all this information as quickly as possible without having them work there, because you don't want to like fire everybody, like have them as an experiment once they're in the company. So that's what we spend a lot of time thinking about ahead of time, looking at who's succeeding in the company and like how to distill that in the interview process. And then, of course, when they're in the chair, like when they're actually in the job, how do you maintain quality? And I think that is very difficult. Like when you have 5 people, it's easy to see who's doing what and of what quality. Now, especially if the company is doing well, it's very easy to actually mask problems. So we've instituted some rituals, like we do defect hunting every week. Like our literal job is to find defects and to like root cause diagnose them. We do what's called touching reality. I think when you become a few layers removed from quote reality or like being in the front lines, it's easy to just be like, oh, they're doing X, Y, Z, but you don't know. So like our jobs are to do things like we call the customers ourselves. We trade support tickets. We have, even if you're really senior as an engineering leader, you're still reading pull requests. I mean, maybe not every day, right? But like you are doing it on a weekly basis so that you are not far from reality. Because I think the hardest lesson that I learned was, you know, we made some hires back in a few years ago where we really just, it was like, just trust that everything, and because the company was growing pretty rapidly during that time, we just thought everything was beneath it was probably going really well until at some point I realized like, oh, actually the people in the front lines were actually not serving the customers, but it was being masked by the fact that we were growing. And so I think since then we were a lot more strict on ourselves and disciplined about making sure we all touch reality on a regular basis so that sort of you don't want the rot to be there for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like from the outside in, having looked at your culture notes and hearing you speak, I think you've built a very special culture. And even if the product does become commodity, I think your approach to building is, I think, unique and probably a source of advantage. As you do think about the next phase for Clipboard, one common sort of perception in the Valley is marketplaces enjoy these network effects and these accumulating advantages. I know you're doing a city by city expansion. Have you seen some of that show up in your metrics? Have you seen like an inflection point where when you get past a certain number of people or healthcare facilities, like an acceleration or some kind of like an uptick? Have you seen some of that? I'm curious what that looks like and how you think about it.
Yeah, we do see it sometimes. I think it's something like 250 shifts per week, what we call a geo or like a metropolitan statistical area. You start seeing that it gets easier to acquire a customer on both sides. But the thing that's interesting about our marketplace is that because you have many different, it's different from Uber in that you don't care what kind of driver it is, as long as they can drive the car. And most drivers are more interchangeable. Like a CNA cannot replace an RN unless the facility actually specifies, or like an RN cannot replace a Lundy RN or like a medical assistant. So when we look at marketplace, like these network effects is actually on a much more micro level. And so you have to have a lot more density. So you have to have enough CNAs specifically. You have to have enough medical assistance specifically. It can't just be like you have, if you have 1,000 providers, but you only have 200 of each type, that's just like not sufficient. So it's really about density of each type. And then even on the healthcare facility shifts, what's interesting there is selection is what matters, right? If you have enough selection, then you start seeing that more people want to pick up those shifts, et cetera, which means that there's going to be more demand. But the selection, again, is by type because the most popular shifts are the non-weekend, like afternoon shifts, for example. And like the weekend shifts are just much harder. And so trying to triage, it does feel, I think at a high level, when you pull back, you're like, obviously more shifts, more people. But then at the micro level, even the shift market, we view them on a micro level of like the AM weekday shift, the PM Wednesday shifts versus the weekend shifts versus the holiday shifts, which are all slightly priced differently. I think that's what makes the problem both very interesting, but also makes running this type of marketplace, I think, probably like 10 times more challenging, maybe 100 times than I initially thought.
Totally.
Yeah, it sounds like that there's a lot of specialization and each category and work type and time frame is different. And so, yeah.
And then there's macro stuff happening. So for example, like facilities requiring COVID vaccination means we actually lost 20% of our providers overnight. These didn't want to get vaccinated, or they didn't, like, that's what they're like, I'm happy to be wearing a mask, but I don't want to be vaccinated. The example of a policy change that like really damaged our supply. Then this was like last year or early this year. Gas prices going up means that now people don't want to travel more than 15 minutes. And then that means like the number of shifts available in that area, it just available shifts for you is diminished, right? Whereas people used to be able to want to be okay traveling an hour, now don't want to travel more than 15 minutes. So then you need even more density in a micro area. So I think those are the macro level effects that can also affect parts of the marketplace. And they can happen very suddenly, right? We weren't like gas prices are going to go crazy. And then that's going to affect a bunch of other behavioral changes.
It almost seems like you have more of a network effect given all the subtleties and like sub markets within your broader market. So curious, like, why are you so convinced that this will be commoditized and another player will come in and be able to like steal share?
Maybe it's just my reluctance to ever be like, so first of all, I don't ever want to be a company that's complacent. Like we've won, we're winning. I think my job is to, unfortunately, to even to my family, Instagram, I'm always the like super paranoid person that's like, okay, so when is the other shoe going to drop and how do we prevent that? And I never want to be overconfident, because I think that then if you're like, oh, we're winning, this is great, you just have all these blind spots on. So I should probably celebrate more. I'm sure my team wants us to celebrate more. I think our team has done a great job. But I guess you just never know, right? Like, world has shown that things that seem unfailable sometimes do fail, even really massive companies, as I'm sure you're all aware of, like, recent news. So, like, these things happen to people who you're just, like, shocked by. And so I don't think I'm a human being running a company. It's not like I'm a different species. So I guess all this is to say is I think I just don't want to be so arrogant to say that we're not going to get disrupted or displaced or something like that. And instead, look towards how do we add more value to our customers and know that there is at least a genuine risk. Maybe it doesn't happen that we become a commodity. Maybe it doesn't happen, but, like, it's certainly definitely within the realm of possibility.
Totally. So we have a few questions we like to ask every guest at the end of the show. So the first one's about feedback. What's the most challenging or difficult feedback you've received, and how have you internalized it and incorporated it moving forward?
I think most difficult feedback may be that I don't like listening to feedback. I don't know. And I think most difficult feedback was, and actually turned it into an action item, was from my husband, who said that, like, whenever I'm trying to make a decision, I always tie it up with how difficult it's going to be. For example, if you think about breaking up with someone, you're not thinking about the breakup. You're thinking about how difficult it's going to be after the breakup. You're like, oh, now I have to go find my own place. What's going to happen to our friend group, whatever it is. And so I think the feedback I got was just like, you can't make a decision cleanly. You're always, like, thinking about all the execution of it. And it wasn't difficult emotionally. It was just like, it was true. I think whenever I think about doing something difficult, it's always like thinking about the difficult part as opposed to whether it's right. So now I do very much try to just separate out the decision, like, what is the right decision, and not even worry about the implementation details. And then give myself some time to think about how to implement it after I've made the decision.
That's a great segue for superpowers. Everyone has a set of skills that they're eerily good at, things that feel like play to them but work to others. What are some things that you like to lean on day to day that you find that you're, like, naturally inclined towards or gifted at?
I love talking to people and getting to know them. I think that's superpower, but certainly it's what allowed us to always stay connected to our customers. And I think it shows in the company, like, when a customer calls, I'm talking to them. I feel like there's nobody else but them in present. So I think that may be a superpower. Probably the only other one I can think of is the learning one, where I just don't have shame or fear of looking stupid. And that and I'm sure there are a lot of founders who probably have that, which is you can't fear looking stupid. And I'm humbled enough to realize that I'm a beginner in many ways for many things. And I kind of enjoy it, just like learning and being in that stupid phase for some period of time.
Last question is, what are you optimizing for at this point in your career? And how has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think early on I was optimizing for, obviously I want the mission to succeed, but on a personal level, I was optimizing for some type of personal achievement of, like, you run a company that's of a certain size or a certain valuation. I think it's both hard to admit, but also, like, easy to admit, because I care about a sense of personal achievement. I think now it's not like I've made it, but I certainly, like, feel a lot more confident about where I am. I think having a family helps put that in perspective. I care about enabling others to do the same. So what I'm looking forward to is having a company that has a big enough impact on the customers, but also for the employees who, for them, like, this is hopefully going to make their careers. That would be so meaningful to me. Like, I love to have people who leave Clipboard, do their own thing, but have that stamp of kind of people who were, like, early at Stripe or early at Airbnb. You're just like, oh, wow, they're impressive because they were early there. That's what I want to give to the employees by making the company some, quote, whatever you define success as.
Amazing. This has been such a fantastic conversation. I feel like there's so many, like, golden nuggets across being scrappy and relentlessly resourceful to scaling, to think about culture and personal growth. Really impressed by the growth at Clipboard, and we're rooting for you. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime.